Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. I'm excited about our show today. We have a very interesting topic to all you ladies and men out there. We're going to be dispelling some myths and getting some updates around breast augmentation and rejuvenation. My guests today are Dr. John Connors, one of Atlanta's leading plastic surgeons. He's from Plastic Surgery of Atlanta. He's double board certified in general surgery and also plastic surgery. He's been in Atlanta for about 5 years and been doing plastic surgery for about 10. And his specialties include breast augmentation and nose surgery. So welcome.
Thank you.
And we also have joining with us today Ashley Smith. And Ashley is one of the implant account reps for Mentor Worldwide. And they are one of the only plant manufacturer, I think the only one, right, Ashley,
in the
United States, and they've been in this business for about 25 years, so welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
So, Dr. Connor, why don't you just start by telling us a little bit about your practice and where you are and kind of how you got it going.
Yeah, sure. We have a, I'm a solo practitioner here in Atlanta. I've been about, like as you said, Tanya, 5 years. And our office is off of Mount Vernon in the perimeter area just north of Buckhead. Mm-hmm. And we have a wonderful office. It's almost like a boutique office.
I've been there. Yeah. It's like Hollywood girls. Go visit.
Well, we tried to, you know, dumb down the medical, you know, sterile feeling. Yeah, we wanted to make it feel comfortable for everybody that comes through. So we've been there for about a year and a half. And we're busy. We love to see patients. And we kind of take care of them on a personal level.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you operate in the office at Northside, St. Joe's? You're kind of on the Pill Hill area.
Right. So we're right within, striking distance of all the main hospitals. We do some procedures in our office, mm-hmm. but some of the major procedures that, the breast augmentations mm-hmm. and some of the other big procedures, we operate in the hospital.
Okay, very good. Yeah. And Ashley, tell us a little bit about how long you've been doing this and your background a little bit.
Well, I've been doing this for about 6 years, and I've worked for Johnson & Johnson for that time. And Mentor is actually a part of Johnson & Johnson. And I specifically really focus a lot on breast reconstruction, and I do also focus on augmentation as well, but that's really where my heart is the breast reconstruction part of this. And, you know, with breast implants, it can really make a woman happier. I mean, depending on, what they want in life and everything.
Goals.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
so I really like it.
Very good. And for those of you who can't see, because we're on the radio, Ashley's wearing her pink pin, so I know she's a true supporter. So we really appreciate that. Well, let's get into our topic of today, which is breast augmentation, rejuvenation, reconstruction, kind of that whole area. Let's start. Where would you like to start, Dr. Kahn?
Well, breast augmentation is one of the most popular procedures that we as plastic surgeons perform. I think the number that I saw recently in 2012 was almost 300,000 procedures.
The number one cosmetic surgery performed in the United States.
Surgical procedure.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So it's very popular. Mm-hmm. And, I think one of the things that we had discussed earlier is there's a lot of myths surrounding breast augmentation. And we in our office, when we see patients, we see, 5-10 patients a day, mm-hmm. and I would say 75% of those patients bring to us questions that either they've gotten on the internet or mm-hmm. friends or somehow circulated out there somewhere, mm-hmm. some myths about the procedure and implants themselves.
So why don't we start with talking about a little bit about the procedure and why people have the procedure, and then we'll kind of go back and try to kind of dispel those myths.
Sure.
So what are some of the main reasons? Body image, certainly, increased confidence. What do your patients tell you when they come about why they're having this procedure?
A majority of our patients have been mothers.
Mm-hmm.
They delivered babies, and their bodies changed after they delivered the babies. And typically, in the time after delivery, their breast volume decreased.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we hear on a daily basis is, I want to get back, the form and the shape that I had before pregnancy or at mm-hmm. the time of pregnancy. So mainly it's women that are trying to, number one, achieve, like you said, the esteem and the self-preservation that they had before mm-hmm. they had children.
Mm-hmm.
We do see patients also that for shape and symmetry and proportion, balance, would like breast augmentation to fill out clothes and feel better in bathing suits.
Are you seeing that there's more younger patients coming in?
You know, I think it's probably equal, you know.
Because I hear that. I mean, my daughter's 26. I know some of her friends have had augmentation already, and they've had great results. They're happy about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, the awareness has increased. So I think patients, you know, talk about it with their friends more readily. I think that in plastic surgery, you know, in general, I think it's a little more open. So I would say that we in our practice, you know, our practice is getting busier every day and every year. So we are seeing more younger patients. There is an age cutoff
for
breast augmentation. So let's
talk about, we were talking about that before we came on air. So
for breast augmentation with saline implants, patients have to be 18 or older. And for silicone implants, 22 years of age or older. And that has to do with what the shell of the implant is filled with, either salt water or silicone cohesive gel.
So how do you determine, does the patient and you together, I'm sure, determine if it's if you're going to go the silicone or the saline route? So what are some considerations?
Well, in my office and, you know, my staff, they hear me tell patients this every day. I want the patient to be educated. I think an educated patient understands all options for them. So I do not push a patient down one way or one other way that I'd be, you know, happy with. I educate them and I tell them the risks, the benefits. I feel like for some patients, saline implants, and Ashley might be able to jump in here, but I feel like saline implants are a little stiffer, a little harder, a little more artificial feel and look. And I think the silicone-based implants, the cohesive gel, are a little softer, a little more natural. So I have a number of tricks in the office, questions that I ask, pictures that I have them look at, some drawings that I've made, and I really tease it out of them because this is an individual, you know, decision for each patient, and I customize it for that patient.
So, Ashley, since we have the expert here at the table, why don't you guide us through a little bit on the implant itself, some of the considerations, the sizes, what kind of goes into helping patients make decisions about that and differences with different outcomes. Kind of educate us a few minutes on that.
Well, with the saline versus the silicone, it's really the feel. They feel more natural because the saline is filled with salt water, like Dr. Connors was saying. But silicone is filled with a silicone, with a gel, with a cohesive gel. And it's really the difference, what would feel more natural under a person's breast, a bag of water or a bag of jelly. So it's going to feel a little bit more like your natural breast tissue. And as far as safety goes, you know, our data shows, I mean, they're both very safe implants. One just has a little bit higher of a rupture rate, which is the saline. The saline at 10 years had a 9.7 rupture rate versus the gel at 4.2% at 7 years. So there's a little bit of about half the difference.
So aside from the rupture rate, the side effects of saline just gets kind of reabsorbed because there's so much saline in your body, right?
Right, exactly.
And then for the silicone.
Well, because it's cohesive, if we cut a silicone gel, this is third generation silicone that we use nowadays. And if you cut it in half, what would happen is nothing. The silicone gel wouldn't run out into your body.
Together.
It stays together because it's cohesive. Now, there's been a lot of talk about gummy bear implants that have now recently become on the market. Well, really, there is no such thing as a gummy bear implant, so to say. What there is just a more cohesive gel. So the shaped implants that are out now that have just been FDA approved, they have is just a little bit more cohesiveness. But as far as safety goes, it's the exact same as far with each implant as far as the gels go. And then with the profiles, we have a number of different profiles depending on how patients want to look. So let's say somebody comes into Dr. Connors and they say, I want to look as natural as possible. I don't want anyone to be able to tell that I had breast implants. Then he may choose a moderate plus or a moderate profile implant. If he has somebody who comes in and says, I want to look augmented, I want them to sit really high, I don't want to have to wear a bra to get cleavage, then he may choose a high profile implant or ultra high, which you can see right there. And all that's the difference is the base diameter of the implant's a little bit more narrow, and it's filled a little bit more, so it gives you more projection, which is really just
filling out. Yes. So in terms of helping patients to decide, it's something that you walk through together. There's a lot of considerations. There's a lot of options on the market.
Yes.
It kind of depends on the goals of the patient and what they're looking for.
Absolutely. Okay. And a lot of times it's also, you know, this is more of an an objective decision. You know, mm-hmm. I make a lot of measurements. I joke with patients. I feel like a tailor. You know, I have calipers and I have measuring devices.
Good to pay attention to detail if we're going to do this once, right?
Well, because, you know, you have two implants sitting here in front of you, Tanya.
Right.
One has a lot of projection. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's really projected almost like a pyramid off mm-hmm. the table. The other is relatively flat, mm-hmm. almost like a pizza shape.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I show the patients the options, I mean, there are hundreds of combinations of volume and shape and consistency. And so patients are confused. They don't know. And a lot of times they rely on their physician to make their decision for them. But I think that's key. But I've got to incorporate the patient as well because, again, like I said, it's their decision at the end of the day. And this has got to be customized to fit their body and their goal.
Right. So I know sometimes looking at implants on the table when you show them to patients, you kind of have a hard time imagining what that would be like on you. But I know in your office you have some unique tools. So you use imaging.
Oh, we do. Yeah, we love imaging.
Why don't we talk a little bit about how before people make the investment, you can help them actually see.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want anyone to get the impression that I'm a computer mm-hmm. geek, but I love technology. Our office is very technology-based, and I do have an instrument, a computer system that takes 3D pictures of patients. Mm-hmm. And we can take a picture of a patient and then take their measurements. We size them. My nurse expert sizes them with volume. Patient chooses either a definitive volume, let's say 300 cc's, and we convert cup sizes. Patients say, I want to be a D cup or I want to be a C cup. We convert that into volume. We really educate them as mm-hmm. far as what that means. Because a cup size at Victoria's Secret is not a cup size at Target. They're all
and that's my orientation, I'll just tell you, yes.
Yeah, so it's tough. Mm-hmm. And so we convert it into a volume, and then we can take that picture and take an implant, the shape, the projection, and put it in that patient's picture and then show them the potential before and after.
Mm-hmm. So I'd actually kind of get to a look on what I would look like at different sizes.
You can.
Before
yeah.
we have, as a part of the decision-making process.
Right. We can take those implants out of your computer picture and mm-hmm. put a different one in, different mm-hmm. projection, different style. Mm-hmm. And
then does it rotate? So I would see like a front view, a side view, or whatever.
It's
so
great.
I can get a good
pictures
feel.
Pictures worth a thousand words.
I
it's great.
That.
And patients love it. And it really helps. Really helps kind of them understand. And the one benefit that I think is great is that, you know, nobody's chest and nobody's breasts are exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tell patients that breasts are sisters. They're not identical twins. They're a little different. And the measurements a lot
analogy.
Of times, we'll tease that out, the measurements that I make. Mm-hmm. But when I put it on the computer and I rotate their chest around and turn it in certain ways, they say, oh, my gosh, I had no idea that my rib cage was different from one side versus the other. And so it's a great educational tool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right in that being able to visualize it, since it is a big investment and a life-changing thing for a lot of people, is a big step in helping them make a decision, probably. And I think probably one of the questions along the process, one of the biggest things that I hear from my friends is, how big do you go? How do you decide? How will it look? So if you have tools in the office that can help visualize that, I think that really helps along the way.
It really does.
Okay.
And as we said, the objective measurements mm-hmm. really guide us to the implant size.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a patient that comes in and says, you know, listen, I want X number of cc's, we, you know, sometimes we have to educate them and say,
them what
listen,
that's
it's
gonna
not
look like on you,
right?
Or, yeah.
Or it's not going to work, or it could set you up for, you know, significant problems
right.
down the road. And so we educate them, and
okay.
that's, we take pride in that.
So we take a lot of time, a lot of measuring, a lot of looking before we do anything. But let's move on to the actual surgery. So can you just kind of walk us through what a typical breast augmentation surgery would entail?
Sure. Well, the other education component is, where is the incision? You know, because we'd have to have an access incision to place the implant. And a majority of the implants that I place are under the muscle, so under the pectoralis major muscle, and I think that protects the upper pole and protects the implant. Mm-hmm. But incision choice could be in the armpit, and a lot of times I use an endoscope, a laparoscopic-type tool that they use in mm-hmm. general surgery mm-hmm. and with a camera to dissect under the muscle from the armpit. I can make an incision around the nipple or areolar complex, mm-hmm. and some cases I don't have to lift that to rejuvenate the nipple areola, but sometimes I do. Mm-hmm. So that's in combination with a breast lift. Majority of our patients choose the inframammary incision right there at the bra line. And that incision is a great incision, I think, not only for access to get under the breast tissue. I don't have to cut into the breast tissue and disrupt any of the, mm-hmm. the nerves, the gland, the ducts.
Mm-hmm.
It allows me to sculpt a pocket underneath that pectoralis muscle, but then when I'm finished, I do put some internal supporting bra stitches that help scar that fold down and control it.
Mm-hmm.
All the stitches are dissolvable.
Mm-hmm.
And I sit patients up and down in the operating room. You know,
I
don't know if you've seen mm-hmm. it. Some patients say they see it on Nip Tuck or some other mm-hmm. shows, but we do. We check for symmetry, mm-hmm. and us plastic surgeons are kind of sticklers for detail, mm-hmm. and so we see things that others don't. But that's a real opportunity for us to see what gravity and mm-hmm. The effects of the implant will have. And then afterwards, I put patients in a lot of tape. You know, it's almost like a tape cast, but mm-hmm. it controls swelling and controls shape, and then a bra afterwards. And
mm-hmm.
as far as postoperative recovery, in the first week, we remove all the tape. We teach patients how to take care of their incisions. We use some very specific, special medicine to control discomfort afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
I always kind of joke with my patients, if we did painless surgery, patients would get themselves into trouble by doing too much activity.
Probably
and
true.
And we've had patients,
so
you know,
it's a good
clean
gauge of what you should and should not be
right,
doing.
Clean their attics mm-hmm. and things like that they shouldn't. So we coach them, you know, on their activity, what they can and can't do, heavy lifting. Typically get them back on a treadmill at about 2 weeks, doing some light cardio, and then back mm-hmm. at the gym at about a month.
Mm-hmm. And then is this mostly outpatient or inpatient?
It is. It's outpatient.
Okay.
I would say 95% of my procedures I perform as an outpatient
mm-hmm.
Because I want patients to get home, to move around. As a nurse, you know, the risk of clots in the legs mm-hmm. and other kind of, you know, mm-hmm. pneumonias and things.
Gotta get up.
We got to get them up moving.
Gotta get up.
Light that fire. But they do well. And they, with the regimen that we have, pretty strict protocol afterwards, patients do really well.
Okay. And about how long a procedure is it? So from start to finish in the OR?
About an hour and a half.
Okay, and then how long would they be in the center themselves? Do you monitor
typically,
them for a while?
Yeah, they come in about an hour ahead of time.
Okay.
We do place an IV, and they talk to the nurses mm-hmm. and the anesthesiologist, and then about an hour afterwards. So, you know, it's a good 3 hours.
Okay, and then what are things post-op that they might be concerned about that they should report back into you? What are you concerned about?
You know, looking back, I keep a very close eye on all my patients. I enter them all into a computer program, and we look at complications and risks and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the best way for us to monitor, you know, our performance. And I recently have started to incorporate a funnel device that looks almost like a pastry chef's icing tool that
mm-hmm.
they put, words
mm-hmm.
on a birthday cake.
Right.
One of the biggest complications with breast augmentation and breast implant surgery has been capsular contracture. And capsular contracture is the scar tissue that forms around an implant itself. And over time, it's been shown to squeeze on that implant
mm-hmm.
and can cause some discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
The rate currently is about 15 to 20% of patients that undergo breast augmentation can suffer that complication and may need surgery in the future.
Do you do something preventatively?
Well, we don't know exactly what causes it.
Okay.
There are some situations after surgery like a hematoma, which is a blood clot around the implant. Infection is very low, but that can increase the risk of capsular contracture. But there's been some recent theories and data that supports the possibility of a very subclinical little infection or colonization of bacteria around that implant that can cause inflammation that causes the capsular contracture. So handling the implant, my gloves touching the patient's skin and then grabbing an implant and putting it in, theoretically could increase that risk. So now I don't even touch the implant. It comes from Ashley's factory in Dallas, United States, to the operating room. I open it. I dump it into this very funny-looking funnel device, and then it gets placed under the muscle and in the pocket. So I never touch it. And I think that's going to decrease the risk of capsular contracture. I'm confident we've got some data that's kind of out there,
mm-hmm.
and we're looking at that. So that's number one. As we talked about, bleeding is always a risk. And, you know, in the past 10 years, I've had one or two patients that have had some bleeding after surgery. And those patients, I preempt all my patients currently with my little story. Because anecdotally, you know, one patient, you know.
And then we'll remember stories.
Yeah.
Then we'll remember statistics.
But one of my patients was a personal trainer. And she felt like after her breast augmentation, although I said treadmill at 2 weeks, she could do a leg workout at 5 days after surgery. And so increasing her blood pressure with a pretty rigorous lower body leg exercise program, she had some bleeding. It's rare, but it happens.
Mm-hmm.
otherwise, it's a relatively low risk, low complication procedure, and the patient satisfaction is tremendous. The studies currently show a 98%+ patient satisfaction, and if patients are happy, they tell their friends. And
absolutely,
yeah.
Very good. Back to the quality assurance procedures. Is there anything, Ashley, you want to weigh in on? I'm sure that you, as a manufacturer with the FDA looking over you, have to go to extreme lengths.
Oh, yes.
Since it's going to live inside the body for a very long time.
And it's really one of the most studied medical devices out on the market, which is insane to me. I mean, it's more studied than heart devices, more studied than valves or hips because of the controversy that surrounded it back in 1991. Mm-hmm. So it's really a very safe implant, and the FDA really does look over our shoulders a lot about the quality and how we're manufacturing these and making sure that the cohesiveness is at a level where it's not going to leak. There's been literally millions of women that have had breast implants and nothing has happened. And so, I mean, not nothing, but I'm saying as far as safety goes, mm-hmm. not many women would not have had breast implants if there was a real mm-hmm. issue with them. Mm-hmm. So the FDA does make sure that we are on the ball. And we have studies. I mean, we have one of the largest studies that is currently going on still right now. It was an adjunct study that happened after it was approved back in 2006 to make sure that the safety and the follow-up of patients who have gotten silicone breast implants, that we're following them, that they're getting their MRI screenings, and that we're reporting that data back to the FDA to make sure that they are very safe. And
very good.
And the FDA has also made sure that the Cancer Research Institute, along with some other facilities, have looked at if there was any link to silicone breast implants and cancer, or silicone breast implants and connective tissue disorder. And there was never found to be a connection between the two.
Very good.
Just to add to Ashley's comments, patients will come in all the time and say, well, listen, I read on the internet that there's a huge risk of the silicone traveling through my body and causing medical problems. Back in the early 90s, one of the issues that was brought up was the possibility that the silicone breast implants contributed to the development of rheumatoid arthritis and some autoimmune diseases. And when the FDA learned of this and they went to both the manufacturing companies as well as the plastic surgeons, neither of us had a very good log. We just were, back in the 70s and early 80s, we just didn't track our patients very well. So we didn't have a very good objective way of disputing some of the claims. And so, when the silicone breast implants were pulled off the market in 1991, it was for that reason. And then one of the other reasons was plastic surgeons' reoperation rate was significantly high. It was almost 25-30% of patients with breast augmentation were reoperated on. Well, when we looked back at the data, patients were being reoperated on because they wanted bigger sizes.
Not because of the implant.
Not because of the malfunction of the implant.
We didn't ask the right questions.
Right. So I think
when we did ask.
What came of that was that thousands of patients were studied. All of the medical issues that were brought up were basically proven not to be associated. So the FDA did put breast implants back on the market. I think the product, the technology is significantly better nowadays. But not only that, we as plastic surgeons learned that we track our patients very closely and in concert with the manufacturing companies. All of us are pretty much investigators that track our patients. And I think the outcomes of the patients, we treat our patients differently, from a funnel device that we now use to antibiotics in the operating room to selection of implants. Mm-hmm. So it's really a wonderful procedure, and the process is great for patients, and the patient satisfaction is tremendous.
Okay, before we jump into the myths, are there any patients that are really not a candidate for implants?
Well, any patient that comes that doesn't meet the age restrictions, obviously. Those
is
patients,
there an upper age restriction? Just saying.
There's not. No. From the FDA and from the manufacturer standpoint, there's not. But patients that have an active infection, anytime there's an infection, you always worry about. It is a medically inserted device, so you want to make sure it doesn't have an ongoing infection. And I make sure that patients, both before as well as after breast implant surgery, if they are going to go to the dentist, because every time we brush our teeth, we get showered by bacteria. So my patients, I put them on a little antibiotic before they see the dentist to prevent that risk. Patients with a history of an ongoing treated neoplasm or cancer, so anybody with cancer that's being treated actively is probably not the best candidate. I think patients with unrealistic goals, and we talk to them about that and their candidacy. So that's pretty
very
much
good. All right. Well, before the show, when we were in the green room, we were talking a little bit about some of the myths associated with breast augmentation. Everything from, I think I might get cancer, I think I'm going to rupture it, I think I need to have new implants every 10 years. So let's jump into some of those.
Sure. The first one is, does it increase my risk of breast cancer?
Mm-hmm.
And there are 8 to 9 white journal scientific papers that have been published that that show that patients with breast implants have a decreased incidence of breast cancers. Why is that? Well, you know, possibly women that are interested in breast augmentation have a smaller breast volume. We don't really have a definitive answer for it, but so that's been debunked, and I tell patients that. The other is the, will I have to exchange my breast implants every 10 years? And I just tell patients, listen, it's not like your car. You don't have to, it's not a 60,000-mile, tire change or anything like that. The rupture rate, as Ashley was stating, for silicone is less than 0.5% per year. So at 10 years, 4 to 5 patients will suffer a rupture. Now, because it's cohesive gel, that would be picked up on an MRI.
Mm-hmm.
And what a rupture is, just to define it for the listeners, is that think of a paperclip. You bend that paperclip over and over and over. Eventually, it'll break. Mm-hmm. And same with the shell. The shell of that implant is a thin polymer of silicone. And it can crack and break, but at 95% of patients are doing great at 10 years. It's a great.
Very good. What about breastfeeding with implants?
Well, for my patients, a majority of those implants are under the breast gland,
mm-hmm.
under the muscle. So I haven't disrupted the gland mm-hmm. or the ducts.
Mm-hmm.
The patients that I worry about, so those patients should be fine.
Mm-hmm.
I always coach patients when they get pregnant. Listen. You got to treat the skin, so moisturize. You got to support, heavier breasts that are becoming engorged with mm-hmm. milk and everything. So, breast support, breast education for skin. For patients that have undergone a lift and then become pregnant, only give or take from the medical literature, 70 to 80% of women are able to breastfeed and sustain a baby without supplemental formula.
Mm-hmm.
So they. 70%, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
With breast surgery, I tell patients it might drop to 50 to 60%. So
you kind of set a realistic expectation.
Realistic expectation. Yeah. It's not going to drop it down to zero.
Mm-hmm.
There are some patients that wouldn't be able to breastfeed even if they didn't have
right.
breast surgery. So, but a majority do, and they do fine.
Okay, very good. I want to jump from breast augmentation to rejuvenation, reconstruction, kind of a few, touch on those areas a little bit.
So the incidence of breast cancer, everybody knows, is relatively mm-hmm. prevalent. I did read something the other day that only something like 7 out of 10 patients undergo reconstruction, and it might even be less than that.
Mm-hmm.
And only 25% of patients with breast cancer are counseled before their definitive surgical treatment of the breast cancer about the options for reconstruction.
Mm, that seems unusually low.
It's low, and I think education is key.
Mm-hmm.
Ashley might have some more objective data.
You said you felt passionate about that, Ashley, on the reconstruction side. So.
Well, it's just what Dr. Connors was saying is that women aren't getting counseled, a mm-hmm. lot of women. I mean, and in today's age, there's no reason why you cannot have breast reconstruction if you're a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I think we do a better job maybe in the urban areas of counseling, but once you got out in the rural, they may not have the option of even a breast reconstruction surgeon or even
mm-hmm.
being told that they have that option to reconstruct mm-hmm. their breast. They may only get the option, you're going to have a mastectomy and that's your life from now on. Here's a name of a company that can provide you with a prosthesis and there you go. I just think that, women should absolutely be educated. And as a company, we're putting a lot of money and a lot of support with the cancer wellness community and some other local organizations around town, like the Young Survivors Coalition, to make sure that we do our job as a manufacturer to help educate women on their options.
So you bring up a good point. We're very lucky in Atlanta that we have good plastic surgeons, good board-certified options for women, Dr. Connor being one of the premier ones. But how does your company reach out to the rural areas? Do they do it through the internet? Do they do it?
Well, we do it, one, through the internet. We have a great website, Your Breast Options, and it'll give you also, a lot of good and helpful tips on breast reconstruction and just a lot of, it's a really good knowledge source and also has some video tips from women, well, videos of women who have gone through breast reconstruction. But really, it's down to the rep in the area. That if you travel, whenever I travel outside of Atlanta, I make sure to stop off at general surgeons' offices and drop off our breast reconstruction pamphlets, mm-hmm. because I know that they're probably not going to give, you know, hand those out at the general surgeon office. So just as you know, the feet on the ground, the rep is the one who could really make an impact.
And I know that a long time ago, back when insurance didn't pay for reconstruction and we did different procedures, we'd have the surgery first and then we'd have reconstruction later. There's actually a lot coinciding right at the time of the mastectomy. You're actually doing reconstruction right then. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. The U.S. government, the federal government now mandates.
Oh, correct.
Insurance companies to cover breast reconstruction. When I see patients in the office, they've just received a diagnosis of breast cancer. Mm-hmm. They're devastated, and understandably so. The options for managing their breast cancer are twofold: mastectomy, mm-hmm. removal of the breast, or a breast conserving option. Mm-hmm. So the possibilities for reconstruction, if it is a mastectomy, or even with a subtotal, with a breast conserving mm-hmm. management, the reconstructive from a plastic surgery standpoint, the options are tremendous. Mm-hmm. So you're bombarding these patients that are being educated about reconstruction with a tremendous amount of information, mm-hmm. and a lot of times they've got to make a decision quickly. And so you're right; some patients will opt for a mastectomy. They just need to kind of decide later.
Right.
And so we do a lot of immediate reconstruction, and we use tissue expanders from Mentor, which are fabulous. Mm-hmm. And then the patients will be expanded, their tissues are expanded, and we place a definitive implant later, whether it's saline or silicone. We can use autologous tissue, muscle and skin and soft tissue from either the back or the stomach. There's a tremendous number of options for patients. One of the new options is using autologous fat, patients' own fatty tissue, to reconstruct their breast.
So tell me a little more about that.
Well, it's experimental right now to take tissue, fatty tissue, and place it somewhere else in the body. We've been doing it for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. But that fatty tissue has to survive. Mm-hmm. And right now, give or take, probably 50% of the fat that's transferred survives. We've been doing some research with certain devices, external devices that are almost like suction cups on the chest that expand the tissue and allow for blood vessel ingrowth and prepare the tissue for fat transfer. We take fat from the abdomen, the waist, certain areas, and we transfer it, take it out of the body from one mm-hmm. area and place it in the breast. I'm actually doing some research, basic science research, at the St. Joseph's Emory Labs to look at fat cells and how do we make those fat cells live longer and a little more predictably. Mm-hmm. And it's really exciting stuff. It's cutting edge, but mm-hmm. it's more research right now. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's pretty much the way it's going until we have a little bit better definitive studies that show that we're better at it. But plastic surgeons are innovators. You know, we've right. innovated, and one of my professors just passed away, Dr. Joseph Murray, who did the first kidney transplant, a plastic surgeon doing a kidney transplant. So I think when it comes to fat transfer and breast reconstruction, we're innovators, and patients really benefit from all of that.
Mm-hmm. Sounding promising, though.
I think it's promising. I think it's the cutting edge.
Yeah,
it's the future.
Very good. All right. Let's talk a little bit about anything else up and coming. You talked a little bit about the research. Is there anything else coming out? Or, Ashley, in your area, what's the next thing in the implant world?
Well, I can't talk about it because it's not FDA approved
okay,
yet.
Right.
But I would love to.
Can you tell me?
I will let you
me.
Know as soon as they come out. But we do have a lot of actually exciting products coming out. So.
Okay, very good. So stay tuned. Dr. Connor, we've gone through breast augmentation. We've gone through the last thing on my list. We touched a little bit on the recovery, but I know there's also some do's and don'ts in terms of exercise and getting back on your feet and the post-op recovery as we kind of come to a close.
Sure. Well, I think the number one do before surgery is find a board-certified plastic surgeon. I can't emphasize that enough. It is critical.
The lines are getting kind of blurry out there, huh?
Well, they are. They are, and I won't comment on that.
Yep.
But, you know, the American Board of Medical Specialties has 24 boards, two of which are surgery and plastic surgery. with the education and the written exams and the oral exams and the continued maintenance of board certification that we as plastic surgeons go through, you know, it's rigorous.
And it's a, is it a 2 or 3 year fellowship on the plastic surgery side?
It's 2 or 3 years. I did 7 years of general surgery and 3 years of plastic surgery, so 10 years of my life to study surgery. Not because I was a glutton for punishment, because I, you know, I really wanted to.
Extensive, yeah.
I did it for my patients. You know, I really wanted to make sure that, that I had the best training to take care of patients. So it's really important. And it, patients will ask, are you board certified, to their physicians? But they need to really be more specific. They need to make sure that it's, you know, board certified in plastic surgery. You can go to the American Society of Plastic Surgeons website, and you can look up your surgeon and make sure that they are currently board certified. So that's number one, and that's critical to ensure a great outcome.
Qualified surgeon.
Find someone that's board certified. Number two, you know, this came up this morning in my office, smoking. You know, smoking really ravages the tissues, depletes oxygen, and really doesn't allow patients to heal very well. I won't get into it, but there was a recent study out of Toronto that showed that women that stop smoking can really basically save their own lives. They add 9 to 10 years
of
their
life. I heard about that on the radio this morning.
Fascinating things. Really a lot of good stuff about smoking and women in particular. So smoking cessation is key. And there's some vitamins and some other medicines that we really kind of screen patients on, because we decrease their risk of complications and bleeding, infection.
What
afterwards.
About weight loss?
You know, weight loss, patients will come into the office and say, listen, I want to have this procedure, but I want to lose 10 pounds first. And what I've, in my experience, I see that patients will, they'll go to the gym, they'll get a membership, they'll find a trainer, and they'll lose 5 pounds. But the local thrift store or the Cheesecake Factory or carbohydrate heaven is next door, and so they gain that 5 pounds back. And it's kind of a vicious cycle. In my patients that I've operated on, whether it's breast augmentation, tummy tucks, liposuction, this type of surgery is a great motivator, and that 10 pounds all of a sudden becomes 15 or 20 because they feel so good about themselves. So I encourage weight loss. We have a nutrition nurse. We have a nutrition program, so we really hit nutrition hard. But I find that patients who have a goal of losing a certain amount of weight before surgery sometimes never get there.
Right.
And so they just kind of delay.
But they can get a good result from where they are a lot of the time.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then on the exercise post-op, kind of getting back to it, you kind of mentioned a little bit about a couple of weeks before the treadmill. But as far as activity levels, what can they expect to kind of recover? I know they have to wear compression garments for how long? And
yeah, we have surgical bras, and we have a stage one post-operative bra, and then we have a 6 week post-procedure post-op bra, and lots of different types of sports bras for our runners and our active patients that we've actually researched. And
I know that for convenience, you carry a lot of them in the office, so the patients don't have to go shopping. It's just one stop, and you can.
Well, we do, and again, that's the boutique component, the patient care, because patients were having their surgery and they were going to local garment stores, and they were either purchasing the wrong bra or inappropriately measured. So my nurses will measure patients after surgery, and we'll fit them in the perfect bra that will fit, you know, best for them and not cause any problems. So exercise-wise, you know, again, on a treadmill at 2 weeks, keep your heart rate less than 140. It's mainly to keep your blood pressure low. Increased blood pressure means swelling and potential bleeding and the complications with that. And then back in the gym, typically, you know, aerobics, Pilates, those kind of things at about a month. Weightlifting, low reps. I mean, high reps, low weight, so they don't overdo it. Typically about 6 weeks.
Okay, very good. Anything that we haven't covered on breast augmentation you want to weigh in before we sign off?
Gosh, you know, I think this has been pretty comprehensive. You know, I think that, again, patients are super happy. The implants are a fabulous technology that's rigorously researched, not only by plastic surgeons, but the FDA as well as Mentor. Ashley has been a wonderful partner for us as we've gotten busier. We see a lot of her in the office, which is fantastic. Patient education is supreme for an outcome that's going to be fantastic and wonderful and lasts the tests of time.
Okay, very good. And Ashley, would you like to weigh in on anything that we haven't covered in terms of the manufacturing, the implants, the patient education?
Well, I think that we've all done a great job at really going over it. But I will say this, that any person I've ever spoken with who's had an augmentation, the only thing they say is, I wish I'd have done it sooner. They've all been super happy. And that's really their only complaint, is that they wish they would have done it sooner. So I would definitely suggest going and booking at least a consultation with a board-certified plastic surgeon. And, you know, especially when, like Dr. Connors, because he does a really amazing job at being very technical and how he chooses his implants and talking with the patients and how much time he takes. And you're not going to get that with just anyone. And I really want to stress that. You're really not going to get that with just anyone. And so in his office is, and, you know, the office experience, I think, is also very important, because you want to feel at home and you want to be able to speak with the office like they're your friends. And I think that that is something that they've done very well at Dr. Connor's office.
I agree. So. And I've been there, so I can vouch for that. So all you girls who've been procrastinating out there, investigate it. And one last thing, we haven't talked much about cost. I know most doctors don't, but one thing I've found is that where there's a will, there's a way. There's a lot of programs to get it funded, paid for, and whatever. So spend time and go check it out. Get a consult. Talk about everything. I think you're very open to taking care of all aspects of the patient's concerns, from what I've seen.
Absolutely.
Very good. Yeah. Well, thanks, you guys, for our chat today and for having us here. I want to let everybody know how to reach you, Dr. Connor. They can call 404-348-4456 or visit you at www.johnconnorsmd.com. Is that correct?
That's perfect.
And they'd love to see you. And Ashley, can you want to tell us a little bit about how they might find you?
Oh, well, they can go to loveyourlook.com, and that is our breast augmentation website, and it has a lot of good videos and tutorials and information on breast augmentation.
Very good. Thank you so much for both of you being here with us today. I know this will be a much Googled and research after the fact show that we've done. So I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. And I'd like to thank HealthGate.com for sponsoring our show. You can visit www.healthgate.com to find great content, great doctors like Dr. Connor, and some cost savings for you. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.